When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
Chapter 13 of Sir Nigel. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Clive Catterall. Sir Nigel by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Chapter 13. How the comrades journeyed down the old, old road. And now the season of moonless nights was drawing nigh, and the king's design was ripe. Very secretly his preparations were made. Already the garrison of Calais, which consisted of 500 archers and 200 men-at-arms, could, if forewarned, resist any attack made upon it. But it was the king's design not merely to resist the attack, but to capture the attackers. Above all, it was his wish to find the occasion for one of those adventurous passages of arms which had made his name famous throughout Christendom as the very pattern and leader of knight-errant chivalry. But the affair wanted careful handling. The arrival of any reinforcements, or even the crossing of any famous soldier, would have alarmed the French and warned them that their plot had been discovered. Therefore it was in twos and threes, in the creyers and provision ships which were continually passing from shore to shore, that the chosen warriors and their squires were brought to Calais. There they were passed at night through the water gate into the castle, where they could lie hidden, unknown to the townsfolk, until the hour for action had come. Nigel had received word from Chandos to join him at the sign of the Broompod in Winchelsea. 3 days beforehand he and Aylward rode from Tilford all armed and ready for the wars. Nigel was in hunting costume, blithe and gay, with his precious armour and his small baggage trussed upon the back of a spare horse which Aylward led by the bridle. The archer himself had a good black mare, heavy and slow, but strong enough to be fit to carry his powerful frame. In his brigandine of chainmail and his steel cap, with straight strong sword by his side, his yellow longbow jutting over his shoulder, and his quiver of arrows supported by a scarlet baldric, he was such a warrior as any knight might well be proud to have in his train. All Tilford trailed behind them as they rode slowly over the long slope of heathland which skirts the flank of Crooksbury Hill. At the summit of the rise, Nigel reined in Pommers and looked back at the little village behind him. There was the old dark manor house, with one bent figure leaning upon a stick and gazing dimly after him from beside the door. He looked at the high-pitched roof, the timbered walls, the long trail of swirling blue smoke which rose from the single chimney, and the group of downcast old servants who lingered at the gate. John the cook, Weathercote the minstrel, Red Swire the broken soldier. Over the river, amid the trees, he could see the grim grey tower of Waverley, and even as he looked, the iron bell, which had so often seemed to be the hoarse, threatening cry of an enemy, clanged out its call to prayer. Nigel doffed his velvet cap and prayed also, prayed that peace might remain at home, and good warfare, in which honour and fame should await him, might still be found abroad. Then, waving his hand to the people, he turned his horse's head and rode slowly eastward. A moment later Aylward broke from the group of archers and laughing girls who clung to his bridle and his stirrup-straps, and rode on, blowing kisses over his shoulder. So at last the two comrades, gentle and simple, were fairly started on their venture. There are two seasons of colour in those parts, the yellow, when the countryside is flaming with the gorse blossoms, and the crimson, when all the long slopes are smouldering with the heather. So it was now. Nigel looked back from time to time as he rode along the narrow track where the ferns and the ling brushed his feet on either side, and as he looked it seemed to him that wander where he might, he would never see a fairer scene than that of his own home. Far to the westward, glowing in the morning light, rolled billow after billow of ruddy heatherland, until they merged into the dark shadows of Woolmer Forest and the pale clear green of the Butser chalk downs. Never in his life had Nigel wandered far beyond these limits, and the woodlands, the down, and the heather were dear to his soul. It gave him a pang in his heart now as he turned his face away from them. But if home lay to the westward, out there to the east and south was the great world of adventure, the noble stage where each of his kinsmen in turn had played his manly part and left a proud name behind. How often had he longed for this day! And now it had come, with no shadow cast behind it. Dame Ermyntrude was under the king's protection. The old servants had their future assured. The strife with the monks of Waverley had been assuaged. He had a noble horse under him, the best of weapons, and a stout follower at his back. Above all, he was bound on a gallant errand with the bravest knight in England as his leader. All these thoughts surged together in his mind, and he whistled and sang as he rode, out of the joy of his heart, while Pommers sidled and curvetted in sympathy with the mood of his master. Presently, glancing back, he saw from Aylward's downcast eyes and puckered brow that the archer was clouded with trouble. He reined his horse to let him come abreast of him. "How now, Aylward?" said he. "Surely, of all men in England, you and I should be the most blithe this morning, since we ride forward with all hopes of honourable advancement. By St. Paul, ere we see these heathered hills once more, we shall either worshipfully win worship, or we shall venture our persons in the attempt." "These be glad thoughts, and why should you be downcast?" Aylward shrugged his broad shoulders, and a wry smile dawned upon his rugged face.
"I am indeed limp as a wetted bowstring," said he. "It is the nature of a man that he should be sad when he leaves the woman he loves."
"In truth, yes," cried Nigel, and in a flash the dark eyes of Mary Butthorne rose before him, and he heard her low, sweet, earnest voice as he had heard it that night when they had brought her frailer sister back from Shalford Manor, a voice which made all that was best and noblest in a man thrill within his soul. "Yet bethink you, archer, that what a woman loves in man is not his gross body, but rather his soul, his honour, his fame, the deeds with which he has made his life beautiful. Therefore you are winning love as well as glory when you turn to the wars."
It may be so," said Aylward, "but indeed it goes to my heart to see the pretty dears weep, and I would fain weep as well to keep them company. When Mary, or was it Dolly? Nay, it was Martha, the red-headed girl from the mill. When she held tight to my baldric, it was like snapping my heart-string to pluck myself loose."
"You speak of one name, then of another," said Nigel. "How was she called, then, this maid who you love?" Aylward pushed back his steel cap and scratched his bristling head with some embarrassment.
"Her name," said he, "is Mary Dolly Martha Susan Jane Cicely Theodosia Agnes Joanna Kate."
Nigel laughed as Aylward rolled out this prodigious title. "I had no right to take you to the wars," said he, "for by St. Paul it is very clear that I have widowed half the parish. But I saw your aged father, the Franklin. Bethink you of the joy that will fill his heart when he hears that you have done some small deed in France, and so won honour in the eyes of all."
"I fear that honour will not help him to pay his arrears of rent to the sacrist of Waverley," said Aylward. "Out he will go on the roadside, honour and all, if he does not find 10 nobles by next Epiphany. But if I could win a ransom, or be at the storming of a rich city, then indeed the old man would be proud of me. Thy sword must help my spade, Samkin," said he, as he kissed me good-bye. It would indeed be a happy day for him, and for all, if I could ride back with a saddlebag full of gold pieces. And, please God, I shall dip my hand in somebody's pocket before I see Crooksbury Hill once more."
Nigel shook his head, for, indeed, it seemed hopeless to try to bridge the gulf between them. Already they had made such good progress along the bridle path through the heather that the little hill of St. Catherine, the ancient shrine upon its summit, loomed up before them. Here they crossed the road from the south to London, and at the crossing two wayfarers were waiting, who waved their hands in greeting. One, a tall, slender, dark woman upon a white jennet, the other, a very thick and red-faced old man, whose weight seemed to curve the back of the stout grey cob which he bestrode.
"What how, Nigel?" he cried. "Mary has told me that you make a start this morning, and we have waited here this hour and more on the chance of seeing you pass. Come, lad, and have a last stoop of English ale, for many a time amid the sour French wines you will long for the white foam under your nose and the good homely twang of it."
Nigel had to decline the draught, for it meant riding into Guildford town, a mile out of his course, but very gladly he agreed with Mary that they should climb the path to the old shrine and offer a last orison together. The knight and Aylward waited below with the horses, and so it came about that Nigel and Mary found themselves alone under the solemn old Gothic arches in front of the dark shadowed recess in which gleamed the golden reliquary of the saint. In silence they knelt side by side in prayer, and then came forth once more out of the gloom and the shadow into the fresh sunlit summer morning. They stopped ere they descended the path, and looked to right and left at the fair meadows and the blue way curling down the valley.
"What have you prayed for, Nigel?" said she.
"I have prayed that God and his saints will hold my spirit high, and will send me back from France in such a fashion that I may dare to come to you, and claim you for my own."
"Bethink you well what it is you say, Nigel," said she. "What you are to me only my heart can tell, but I would never set eyes upon your face again rather than abate by one inch that height of honour and worshipful achievement to which you may attain."
"Nay, my dear and most sweet lady, how should you abate it, since it is the thought of you which will nerve my arm and uphold my heart?"
"Think once more, my fair lord, and hold yourself bound by no word which you have said. Let it be as the breeze which blows past our faces and is heard of no more. Your soul yearns for honour. To that has it ever turned. Is there room in it for love also? Or is it possible that both shall live at their highest in one mind? Do you not call to mind that Galahad and the other great knights of old have put women out of their lives, that they may ever give their whole soul and strength to the winning of honour? May it not be that I shall be a drag upon you, that your heart may shrink from some honourable task, that it should bring risk and pain to me? Think well before you answer, my fair lord, for indeed my very heart would break if it should ever happen that through love of me your high hopes and great promise should miss fulfilment."
Nigel looked at her with sparkling eyes. The soul which shone through her dark face had transformed it for the moment into a beauty more lofty and more rare than that of her shallow sister. He bowed before the majesty of the woman and pressed his lips to her hand. "You are like a star upon my path which guides me on the upward way," said he. "Our souls are set together upon the finding of honour, and how shall we hold each other back when our purpose is the same?" She shook her proud head.
"So it seems to you now, fair lord, but it may be otherwise as the years pass. How shall he prove that I am indeed a help and not a hindrance?"
"I will prove it by my deeds, fair and dear lady," said Nigel. "Here, at the shrine of the Holy Catherine, on this, the feast of St. Margaret, I take my oath that I will do three deeds in your honour as proof of my high love before I set eyes upon your face again, and these three deeds shall stand as proof to you that if I love you dearly, still I will not let the thought of you stand betwixt me and honourable achievement." Her face shone with her love and her pride.
"I also make my oath," said she, "and I do it in the name of the Holy Catherine, whose shrine is hard by. I swear that I will hold myself for you until these three deeds be done and we meet once more. Also, that if, which may dear Christ forfend, you fall in doing them, then I shall take the veil in Shalford Nunnery, and look upon no man's face again. Give me your hand, Nigel."
She had taken a little bangle of gold filigree work from her arm and fastened it upon his sunburnt wrist, reading aloud to him the engraved motto in old French: "Fais ce que dois, advienne qui pourra, c'est commandé au chevalier." Then for one moment they fell into each other's arms, and with kiss upon kiss, a loving man and a tender woman, they swore their troth to each other. But the old knight was calling impatiently from below, and together they hurried down the winding path to where the horses waited under the sandy bluff. As far as the Shalford crossing, Sir John rode by Nigel's arm, and many were the last injunctions which he gave him concerning woodcraft, and great his anxiety lest he confuse a spray with a brocket, or either with a hind. At last, when they came to the reedy edge of the way, the old knight and his daughter reined up their horses. Nigel looked back at them ere he entered the dark Chantry woods, and saw them still gazing after him and waving their hands. Then the path wound among the trees, and they were lost to sight. But long afterwards, when a clearing exposed once more the Shalford meadows, Nigel saw that the old man upon the grey cob was riding slowly towards St. Catherine's Hill, but that the girl was still where he had seen her last, leaning forward in her saddle and straining her eyes to pierce the dark forest which screened her lover from her view. It was but a fleeting glance through a break in the foliage, and yet in after days of stress and toil in far distant lands, it was that one little picture, the green meadow, the reeds, the slow blue winding river, and the eager, bending, graceful figure upon the white horse, which were the clearest and the dearest image of that England which he had left behind him. But if Nigel's friends had learned that this was the morning of his leaving, his enemies too were on the alert. The two comrades had just emerged from the Chantry woods, and were beginning the ascent of the curving path which leads upward to the old chapel of the martyr, when, with a hiss like an angry snake, a long white arrow streaked under Pommers and struck quivering in the grassy turf. A second whizzed past Nigel's ear as he tried to turn, but Aylward struck the great warhorse a sharp blow over the haunches, and it had galloped some hundreds of yards before its rider could pull up. Aylward followed as hard as he could ride, bending low over his horse's neck while arrows whizzed all around him. "By St. Paul," said Nigel, tugging at his bridle and white with anger, "they shall not chase me across the country as though I were a frightened doe. Archer, how dare you to lash my horse when I would have turned and ridden in upon them?"
"It is well I did so," said Aylward, "or by these 10 finger bones our journey would have begun and ended on the same day. As I glanced round I saw a dozen of them at least among the brushwood. See now how the light glimmers upon their steel caps yonder in the bracken under the great beech tree. Nay, I pray you, my fair lord, do not ride forward. What chance has a man in the open against all these who lie at their ease in the underwood? If you will not think of yourself, then consider your horse, which would have a cloth-yard shaft feathered in its hide ere it could reach the wood."
Nigel chafed in impotent anger. "Am I to be shot at like a popinjay at a fair by any reaver or outlaw that seeks a mark for his bow?" he cried.
"By St. Paul, Aylward, I will put on my harness and go further into the matter. Help me to undress, I pray you." "Nay, my fair lord, I will not help you to your own downfall. It is a match with cogged dice betwixt a horseman on the moor and archers amid the forest. But these men are no outlaws, or they would not dare to draw their bows within a league of the Sheriff of Guildford."
"Indeed, Aylward, I think that you speak truth," said Nigel. "It may be that these are the men of Paul de la Fosse of Shalford, whom I have given little cause to love me. Ah, there is indeed the very man himself." They sat their horses with their backs to the long slope which leads up to the old chapel on the hill. In front of them was the dark, ragged edge of the wood, with a sharp twinkle of steel here and there in its shadows, which spoke of these lurking foes. But now there was a long moot upon a horn, and at once a score of russet-clad bowmen ran forward from amid the trees, spreading out into a scattered line, and closing swiftly upon the travellers. In the midst of them, upon a great grey horse, sat a small misshapen man, waving a cheering as one who sets hounds upon a badger, turning his head this way and that, as he whooped and pointed, urging his bowmen onward up the slope.
"Draw them on, my fair lord, draw them on until we have them out on the down," cried Aylward, his eyes shining with joy. 500 paces more, and then we may be on terms with them. Nay, linger not, but keep them always just clear of arrow shot until our turn has come."
Nigel shook and trembled with eagerness, as with his hand on his sword-hilt he looked at the line of eager, hurrying men. But it flashed through his mind what Chandos had said of the cool head which is better for the warrior than the hot heart. Aylward's words were true and wise. He turned Pommer's head, therefore, and amid a cry of derision from behind them, the comrades trotted over the down. The bowmen broke into a run, while the leader screamed and waved more madly than before. Aylward cast many a glance at them over his shoulder.
"Yet a little further, yet a little further still," he muttered. The wind is towards them, and the fools have forgot that I can overshoot them by 50 paces. Now, my good lord, I pray you for one instant to hold the horses, for my weapon is more avail this day than thine can be. They may make sorry cheer ere they gain the shelter of the wood once more."
He had sprung from his horse, and with a downward wrench of his arm and a push from his knee, he slipped the string into the upper nock of his mighty warbow. Then in a flash he notched his shaft and drew it to the pile, his keen blue eyes glowing fiercely behind it from under his knotted brows. With thick legs planted sturdily apart, his body laid into the bow, his left arm motionless as wood, his right bunched into a double curve of swelling muscles as he stretched the white, well-waxed string, he looked so keen and fierce a fighter that the advancing lines stopped for an instant at the sight of him. Two or three loosed off their arrows, but the shafts flew heavily against the headwind and snaked along the hard turf some score of paces short of the mark. One only, a short, bandy-legged man, whose squat figure spoke of enormous muscular strength, ran swiftly in and then drew so strong a bow that the arrow quivered in the ground at Aylward's feet.
"It is Black Will of Lynchmere," said the bowman. "Many a match have I shot with him, and I know well that no other man in the Surrey marches could have sped such a shaft. I trust that you are houseled and shriven, Will, for I have known you so long that I would not have your damnation upon my soul."
He raised his bow as he spoke, and the string twanged with a rich, deep, musical note. Aylward leaned upon his bow-stave as he keenly watched the long, swift flight of his shaft, skimming smoothly down the wind.
"On him? On him? Oh, no! Over him, by my hilt!" he cried. "There is more wind than I had thought. Nay, nay, friend, now that I have the length of you, you can scarce hope to loose again."
Black Will had notched an arrow and was raising his bow when Aylward's second shaft passed through the shoulder of his drawing arm. With a shout of anger and pain he dropped his weapon, and dancing in his fury he shook his fist and roared curses at his rival.
"I could slay him, but I will not, for good bowmen are not so common," said Aylward. "And now, fair sir, we must on, for they are spreading round on either side, and if once they get behind us, then indeed our journey has come to a sudden end. But ere we go, I would send a shaft through yonder horseman who leads them on."
"Nay, Aylward, I pray you to leave him," said Nigel. "Villain as he is none the less a gentleman of coat armor, and should die by some other weapon than thine."
"As you will," said Aylward, with a clouded brow. "I have been told that in the late wars many a French prince and baron has not been too proud to take his death wound from an English yeoman's shaft, and that nobles of England have been glad enough to stand by and see it done."
Nigel shook his head sadly. "It is sooth you say, archer, and indeed it is no new thing, for that good knight Richard of the Lion Heart met his end in such a lowly fashion, and so did Harold the Saxon. But this is a private matter, and I would not have you draw your bow against him. Neither can I ride at him myself, for he is weak in body, though dangerous in spirit. Therefore we will go upon our way, since there is neither profit nor honour to be gained, nor any hope of advancement." Aylward, having unstrung his bow, had remounted his horse during this conversation, and the two rode swiftly past the little squat chapel of the martyr and over the brow of the hill. From the summit they looked back. The injured archer lay upon the ground, and several of his comrades gathered in a knot around him. Others ran aimlessly up the hill, but were already far behind. The leader sat motionless upon his horse, and as he saw them look back, he raised his hand and shrieked his curses at them. An instant later the curve of the ground had hid them from view, so, amid love and hate, Nigel bade adieu to the home of his youth. And now the comrades were journeying upon that old, old road which runs across the south of England, and yet never turns toward London, for the good reason that the place was a poor hamlet when first the road was laid. From Winchester, the Saxon capital, to Canterbury, the holy city of Kent, ran that ancient highway, and on from Canterbury to the narrow straits where, on a clear day, the farther shore can be seen. Along this track, as far back as history can trace, the metals of the West have been carried, and passed the pack-horses bearing the goods which Gaul sent in exchange. Older than the Christian faith and older than the Romans is this old road. North and south are the woods and the marshes, so that only on the high, dry turf of the chalkland could a clear track be found. The Pilgrim's Way, it is still called, but the pilgrims were the last who ever trod it, for it was already of immemorial age before the death of Thomas a Becket gave a new reason why folks should journey to the scene of his murder.
From the hill of Weston Wood the travellers could see the long white hand which dipped and curved and rose over the green downland, its course marked even in the hollows by the line of old yew-trees which flanked it. Neither Nigel nor Aylward had wandered far from their own country, and now they rode with light hearts and eager eyes, taking note of all the varied pictures of nature and of men which passed before them. To their left was a hilly country, a land of rolling heaths and woods, broken here and there in open spaces round the occasional farmhouse of a franklin. Hackhurst Down, Dunley Hill, and Ranmore Common swelled and sank, each merging into the other. But on the right, after passing the village of Shear and the old church of Gomshall, the whole south country lay like a map at their feet. There was the huge wood of the Weald, one unbroken forest of oak trees, stretching away to the South Downs, which rose olive-green against the deep blue sky. Under this great canopy of trees strange folk lived, and evil deeds were done. In its recesses were wild tribes, little changed from their heathen ancestors, who danced round the altar of Thor, and well was it for the peaceful traveller that he could tread the high open road of the chalkland, with no need to wander into so dangerous a tract, where soft clay, tangled forest, and wild men all barred his progress. But apart from the rolling country upon the left, and the great forest-hidden plain upon the right, there was much upon the road itself to engage the attention of the wayfarers. It was crowded with people. As far as their eyes could carry, they could see the black dots scattered thickly upon the thin white band, sometimes single, sometimes several abreast, sometimes in moving crowds, where a drove of pilgrims held together for mutual protection, or a nobleman showed his greatness by the number of retainers who trailed at his heels. At that time the main roads were very crowded, for there were many wandering people in the land. Of all sorts and kinds they passed in an unbroken stream before the eyes of Nigel and of Aylward, alike only in the fact that one and all were powdered from their hair to their shoes with the grey dust of the chalk. There were monks journeying from one cell to another, Benedictines with their black gowns looped up to show their white skirts, Carthusians in white, and pied Cistercians. Friars also of the three wandering orders, Dominicans in black, Carmelites in white, and Franciscans in grey. There was no love lost between the cloistered monks and the free friars, each looking on the other as a rival who took from him the oblations of the faithful. So they passed on the high road as cat passes dog, with eyes askance and angry faces. Then, besides the men of the church, there were the men of trade. The merchant in dusty broadcloth and Flanders hat, riding at the head of his line of pack-horses. He carried Cornish tin, West Country wool, or Sussex iron if he headed eastward, or if his head should be turned westward, then he bore with him the velvets of Genoa, the ware of Venice, the wines of France, or the armour of Italy and Spain. Pilgrims were everywhere. Poor people for the most part, plodding wearily along with trailing feet and bowed heads, thick staves in their hands and bundles over their shoulders. Here and there, on a gaily caprisoned palfrey, or in the greater luxury of a horse litter, some West Country lady might be seen making her easy way to the shrine of St. Thomas. Besides all these, a constant stream of strange vagabonds drifted along the road. Minstrels who wandered from fair to fair, a foul and pestilent crew, jugglers and acrobats, quack doctors and tooth-drawers, students and beggars, free workmen in search of better wages, and escaped bondsmen who would welcome any wages at all. Such was the throng which set the old road smoking in a haze of white dust from Winchester to the narrow sea. But of all the wayfarers, those which interested Nigel most were the soldiers. Several times they passed little knots of archers, or men-at-arms, veterans from France who had received their discharge, and were now making their way to their southland homes. They were half-drunk, all of them, for the wayfarers treated them to beer at the frequent inns and ale-stakes which lined the road, so that they cheered and sang lustily as they passed. They roared rude pleasantries at Aylward, who turned in his saddle and shouted his opinion of them until they were out of hearing. Once, late in the afternoon, they overtook a body of 100 archers, all marching together with 2 knights riding at their head. They were passing from Guildford Castle to Reigate Castle, where they were in garrison. Nigel rode with the knights for some distance, and hinted that if either was in search of honourable advancement, a wish to do some small deed, or to relieve himself of any vow, it might be possible to find some means of achieving it. They were both, however, grave and elderly men, intent upon their business with no mind for fond wayside adventures, so Nigel quickened his pace and left them behind. They had left Box Hill and Headley Heath upon the left, and the towers of Reigate were rising amid the trees in front of them, when they overtook a large, cheery-faced man with a forked beard, riding upon a good horse, and exchanging a nod or a merry word with all who passed him. With him they rode nearly as far as Bletchingley, and Nigel laughed much to hear him talk, but always under the raillery there was much earnestness and much wisdom in all his words. He rode at his ease about the country, he said, having sufficient money to keep him from want and to furnish him for the road. He could speak all the 3 languages of England, the North, the Middle, and the South, so that he was at home with the people of every shire, and could hear their troubles and their joys. In all parts, in town and in country, there was unrest, he said, for the poor folk were weary of their masters, both of the church and state, and soon there would be such doings in England as had never been seen before. But above all, this man was earnest against the church, its enormous wealth, its possession of nearly 1/3 of the whole land of the country, its insatiable greed for more at the very time when it claimed to be poor and lowly. The monks and friars, too, he lashed with his tongue, their roguish ways, their laziness, and their cunning. He showed how their wealth and that of the haughty lord must always be founded upon the toil of poor humble Peter the ploughman, who worked and strove in rain and cold out in the fields, the butt and laughing-stock of every one, and still bearing up the whole world upon his weary shoulders. He had set it all out in a fair parable, so now, as he rode, he repeated some of the verses, chanting them and marking time with his forefinger, while Nigel and Aylward, on either side of him, with their heads inclined inward, listened with the same attention, but with very different feelings. Nigel, shocked at such an attack upon authority, and Aylward, chuckling as he heard the sentiments of his class so shrewdly expressed. At last the stranger halted his horse outside the 5 Angels at Gatton. "It is a good inn, and I know the ale of old," said he. "When I had finished that dream of Piers the ploughman, which I have recited to you, the last verses were thus: Now I have brought my little book to an end. God's blessing be on him who a drink will me send. I pray you, come in with me and share it." "Nay," said Nigel, "we must on our way, for we have far to go. But give me your name, my friend, for indeed we have passed a merry hour listening to your words." "Have a care," the stranger answered, shaking his head. "You and your class will not spend a merry hour when these words are turned into deeds, and Peter the ploughman grows weary of swinking in the fields, and takes up his bow and his staff in order to set this land in order." "By St. Paul, I expect that we shall bring Peter to reason, and also those who have put such evil thoughts into his head," said Nigel. "So once more I ask your name, that I may know it, if ever I chance to hear that you have been hanged." The stranger laughed good-humouredly. "You could call me Thomas Lackland," said he. "It should be Thomas Lackbrain, if I were indeed to give my true name, since a good many robbers, some in black gowns and some in steel, would be glad to help me upward in the way you speak of. So good day to you, squire, and to you also, archer, and may you find your way back in with whole bones from the wars." That night the comrades slept in Godstone Priory, and early next morning they were well upon their road down the Pilgrim's Way. At Titsey it was said that a band of villains were out in Westerham Wood, and had murdered 3 men the day before, so that Nigel had high hopes of an encounter. But the brigands showed no sign, though the travellers went out of their way to ride their horses along the edges of the forest. Farther on they found traces of their work, for the path ran along the hillside at the base of a chalk quarry, and there in the cutting a man was lying dead. From his twisted limbs and shattered frame it was easy to see that he had been thrown over from above, while his pockets, turned outward, showed the reason for his murder. The comrades rode past without too close a survey, for dead men were no very uncommon objects on the king's highway, and if sheriff or bailiff should chance upon you near the body, you might find yourself caught up in the meshes of the law. Near Sevenoaks, the road turned out of the old Canterbury Way and pointed south toward the coast, leaving the chalklands and coming down into the clay of the Weald. It was a wretched, rutted mule track, running through thick forests with occasional clearings, in which lay the small Kentish villages, where rude, shock-headed peasants, with smocks and galligaskins, stared with bold, greedy eyes at the travellers. Once on the right they caught a distant view of the towers of Penshurst, and once they heard the deep tolling of the bells of Bayham Abbey. But for the rest of their day's journey, savage peasants and squalid cottages were all that met their eyes, with endless droves of pigs who fed upon the litter of acorns. The throng of travellers who crowded the old road were all gone, and only here and there did they meet or overtake some occasional merchant or messenger bound for Battle Abbey, Pevensey Castle, or the towns of the south. That night they slept in a sordid inn, overrun with rats and with fleas, 1 mile south of the hamlet of Mayfield. Aylward scratched vigorously and cursed with fervour. Nigel lay without movement or sound. To the man who has learned the old rule of chivalry, there were no small ills in life. It was beneath the dignity of his soul to stoop to observe them. Cold and heat, hunger and thirst, such things did not exist for the gentleman. The armour of his soul was so complete that it was proof not only against the great ills of life, but even against the small ones. So the flea-bitten Nigel lay grimly still, while Aylward writhed upon his couch. They were now but a short distance from their destination, but they had hardly started on their journey through the forest next morning when an adventure befell them, which filled Nigel with the wildest hopes. Along the narrow winding path between the great oak trees there rode a dark, sallow man in a scarlet tabard, who blew so loudly upon a silver trumpet that they heard the clanging call long before they set eyes on him. Slowly he advanced, pulling up every 50 paces to make the forest ring with another warlike blast. The comrades rode forward to meet him. "I pray you," said Nigel, "to tell me who you are, and why you blow upon this trumpet." The fellow shook his head, so Nigel repeated the question in French, the common language of chivalry, spoken at that age by every gentleman in Western Europe. The man put his lips to the trumpet and blew another long note before he answered. "I am Gaston de Castrier," said he, "the humble squire of the most worthy and valiant knight Raoul de Toubiers, de Pestel, de Grimsard, de Mersac, de Loye, de Bastignac, who also writes himself Lord of Pont. It is his order that I ride always a mile in front of him to prepare all to receive him, and he desires me to blow upon a trumpet, not out of vainglory, but out of greatness of spirit, so that none may be ignorant of his coming, should they desire to encounter him." Nigel sprang from his horse with a cry of joy, and began to unbutton his doublet. "Quick, Aylward, quick," said he. "He comes, a knight-errant comes. Was there ever such a chance of worshipfully winning worship? Untruss the harness while I loose my clothes. Good sir, I beg you to warn your noble and valiant master that a poor squire of England would implore him to take notice of him, and to do some small deed upon him as he passes." But already the Lord of Ponds had come in sight. He was a huge man upon an enormous horse, so that together they seemed to fill up the whole long dark archway under the oaks. He was clad in full armour of brazen hue, with only his face exposed, and of this face there was little visible, save a pair of arrogant eyes and a great black beard, which flowed through the open visor and down over his breastplate. To the crest of his helmet was tied a small brown glove, nodding and swinging above him. He bore a long lance with a red square banner at the end, charged with a black boar's head, and the same symbol was engraved upon his shield. Slowly he rode through the forest, ponderous, menacing, with dull thudding of his charger's hoofs and constant clank of metal, while always in front of him came the distant peal of the silver trumpet, calling all men to admit his majesty and to clear his path ere they be cleared from it. Never in his dreams had so perfect a vision come to cheer Nigel's heart, and as he struggled with his clothes, glancing up continually at this wondrous traveller, he pattered forth prayers of thanksgiving to the good St. Paul, who had shown such loving kindness to his unworthy servant, and thrown him in the path of so excellent and debonair a gentleman. But alas,
how often at the last instant the cup is dashed from the lips. This joyful chance was destined to change suddenly to unexpected and grotesque disaster, a disaster so strange and so complete that through all his life Nigel flushed crimson when he thought of it. He was busily stripping his hunting costume, and with feverish haste he had doffed boots, hat, hose, doublet and cloak, so that nothing remained save a pink jupon and a pair of silken drawers. At the same time Aylward was hastily unbuckling the load with the intention of handing his master his armour piece by piece, when the squire gave one last challenging peal from his silver trumpet into the very ear of the spare horse. In an instant it had taken to its heels, the precious armour upon its back, and thundered away down the road which they had traversed. Aylward jumped upon his mare, drove his prick spurs into her sides, and galloped after the runaway as hard as he could ride. Thus it came about that in an instant Nigel was shorn of all his little dignity, had lost his two horses, his attendant, and his outfit, and found himself a lonely and unarmed man, standing in his shirt and drawers upon the pathway down which the burly figure of the Lord of Ponds was slowly advancing. The knight-errant, whose mind had been filled by the thought of the maiden whom he had left behind at Saint-Jean, the same whose glove dangled from his helmet, had observed nothing that had occurred. Hence all that met his eyes was a noble yellow horse, which was tethered by the track, and a small young man, who appeared to be a lunatic, since he had undressed hastily in the heart of the forest, and stood now with an eager, anxious face, clad in his underlinen, amid the scattered debris of his garments. Of such a person the High Lord of Ponds could take no notice, and so he pursued his inexorable way, his arrogant eyes looking out in the distance, and his thoughts set intently upon the maiden of Saint-Jean. He was dimly aware that the little crazy man in the undershirt ran a long way beside him in his stockings, begging and imploring and arguing. "Just 1 hour, most fair sir, just 1 hour at the longest, and a poor squire of England shall ever hold himself your debtor. Do but condescend to rein your horse until my harness comes back to me. Will you not stoop to show me some small deed of arms? I implore you, fair sir, to spare me a little of your time and a handstroke or two ere you go upon your way." The Lord of Ponds motioned impatiently with his gauntleted hand, as one might brush away an importunate fly. But when at last Nigel became desperate in his clamour, he thrust his spurs into his great war horse, and, clashing like a pair of cymbals, he thundered off through the forest. So he rode upon his majestic way, until 2 days later he was slain by Lord Reginald Cobham in a field near Weybridge. When, after a long chase, Aylward secured the spare horse and brought it back, he found his master seated upon a fallen tree, his face buried in his hands, and his mind clouded with humiliation and grief. Nothing was said, for the matter was beyond words, and so in moody silence they rode upon their way. But soon they came upon a scene which drew Nigel's thoughts away from his bitter trouble, for in front of them there rose the towers of a great building, with a small grey sloping village around it, and they learned from a passing hind that this was the hamlet and abbey of Battle. Together they drew rein upon the low ridge, and looked down into that valley of death, from which even now the reek of blood seems to rise. Down beside that sinister lake, and amid those scattered bushes, sprinkled over the naked flank of the long ridge, was fought that long-drawn struggle between two most noble foes, with broad England as the prize of victory. Here, up and down the low hill, hour by hour, the grim struggle had waxed and waned, until the Saxon army had died where it stood, king, court, housecarl, and fearsman, each in their ranks, even as they had fought. And now, after all the stress and toil, the tyranny, the savage revolt, the fierce suppression, God had made his purpose complete. For here were Nigel the Norman and Aylward the Saxon, with good fellowship in their hearts and a common respect in their minds, with the same banner and the same cause, riding forth to do battle for their old mother England. And now the long ride drew to an end. In front of them was the blue sea, flecked with the white ships. Once more the road passed upward from the heavy wooded plain to the springy turf of the chalk downs. Far to the right rose the grim fortalice of Pevensey, squat and powerful, like one great block of rugged stone, the parapet twinkling with steel caps, and crowned by the royal banner of England.
A flat expanse of reeded marshland lay before them, out of which rose a single wooded hill crowned with towers, and a bristle of masts rising out of the green plain some distance to the south of it. Nigel looked at it, with his hand shading his eyes, and then urged Pommers to a trot. The town was Winchelsea, and there, amid that cluster of houses on the hill, the gallant Chandos must be waiting him. End of chapter 13.
Chapter 14 of Sir Nigel. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Clive Catterall. Sir Nigel by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Chapter 14. How Nigel Chased the Red Ferret. They passed a ferry, wound upward by a curving path, and then, having satisfied a guard of men-at-arms, were admitted through the frowning arch of the Pipewell Gate. There, waiting for them, in the middle of the East Street, the sun gleaming upon his lemon-coloured beard and puckering his single eye, stood Chandos himself, his legs apart, his hands behind his back, and a welcoming smile upon his quaint, high-nosed face. Behind him, a crowd of little boys were gazing with reverent eyes at the famous soldier.
"Welcome, Nigel," said he, "and you also, good archer. I chanced to be walking on the city wall, and I thought, from the colour of your horse, that it was indeed you upon the Udamore Road. How have you fared, young squire errant? Have you held bridges, or rescued damsels, or slain oppressors on your way from Tilford?"
"Nay, my fair lord, I have accomplished nothing. But once I had hopes..." Nigel flushed at the remembrance.
"I will give you more than hopes, Nigel. I will put you where you can dip both arms to the elbow into danger and honour, where peril will sleep with you at night, and rise with you in the morning, and the very air you breathe be laden with it. Are you ready for that, young sir?"
"I can but pray, fair lord, that my spirit will rise to it."
Chandos smiled his approval, and laid his thin brown hand on the youth's shoulder.
"Good," said he.
"It is the mute hound which bites the hardest. The babbler is ever the hangback. Bide with me here, Nigel, and walk upon the ramparts. Archer, do you lead the horses to the sign of the Broom Pod in the High Street, and tell my varlets to see them aboard the cog Thomas before nightfall. We sail at the second hour after curfew. Come hither, Nigel, to the crest of the corner turret, for from it I will show you what you have never seen." It was but a dim and distant white cloud upon the blue water, seen far off over the Dungeness Point, and yet the sight of it flushed the young squire's cheeks and sent the blood hot through his veins. It was the fringe of France, that land of chivalry and glory, the stage where fame and name were to be won. With burning eyes he gazed across at it, his heart rejoicing to think that the hour was at hand when he might tread that sacred soil. Then his gaze crossed the immense stretch of the blue sea, dotted over with the sails of fishing boats, until it rested upon the double harbour beneath, packed with vessels of every size and shape, from the pessoners and crayers which plied up and down the coast, to the great cogs and galleys, which were used either as warships or merchantmen as the occasion served. One of them was at that instant passing out to sea, a huge galleass, with trumpets blowing and nakers banging, the flag of St. George flaunting over the broad purple sail, and the decks sparkling from end to end with steel. Nigel gave a cry of pleasure at the splendour of the sight. "Aye, lad," said Chandos, "it is the Trinity of Rye, the very ship on which I fought at Sluys. Her deck ran blood from stem to stern that day. But turn your eyes this way, I beg you, and tell me if you see aught strange about this town."
Nigel looked down at the noble straight street, at the Roundel Tower, at the fine church of St. Thomas, and the other fair buildings of Winchelsea. "It is all new," said he. "Church, castle, houses, all are new."
"You are right, fair son. My grandfather can call it to mind the time when only the conies lived upon this rock. The town was down yonder by the sea, until one night the waves rose upon it, and not a house was left. See, yonder is Rye, huddling also on a hill, the two towns like poor sheep when the waters are out. But down there, under the blue water, and below the camber sand, lies the true Winchelsea. Tower, cathedral, walls and all, even as my grandfather knew it, when the first Edward was young upon the throne. For an hour or more, Chandos paced upon the ramparts with his young squire at his elbow, and talked to him of his duties, and of the secrets and craft of warfare, Nigel drinking in and storing in his memory every word from so revered a teacher. Many a time in after life, in stress and in danger, he strengthened himself by the memory of that slow walk, with the blue sea on one side and the fair town on the other, when the wise soldier and noble-hearted knight poured forth his precept and advice as the master workman to the apprentice.
"Perhaps, fair son," said he, "you are like so many other lads who ride to the wars, and know so much already that it is waste of breath to advise them."
"Nay, my fair lord, I know nothing, save that I would fain do my duty, and either win honourable advancement or die worshipful on the field."
"You are wise to be humble," said Chandos, "for indeed he who knows most of war knows best that there is much to learn. As there is a mystery of the rivers and a mystery of woodcraft, even so there is a mystery of warfare by which battles may be lost and gained. For all nations are brave, and where the brave meets the brave, it is he who is crafty and warwise who will win the day. The best hound will run at fault if he be ill laid on, and the best hawk will fly at check if he be badly loosed, and even so the bravest army may go awry if it be ill handled. There are not in Christendom better knights and squires than those of the French, and yet we have had the better of them, for in our Scottish wars and elsewhere we have learned more of this same mystery of which I speak."
"And wherein lies our wisdom, honoured sir?" asked Nigel. "I also would fain be warwise, and learn to fight with my wits as well as with my sword." Chandos shook his head and smiled.
"It is in the forest and on the down that you learn to fly the hawk and loose the hound," said he.
"So also it is in the camp and on the field that the mystery of war can be learned. There only has every great captain come to be its master. To start, he must have a cool head, quick to think, soft as wax before his purpose is formed, hard as steel when once he sees it before him. Ever alert he must be, and cautious also, but with judgment to turn his caution into rashness where a large gain may be put against a small stake. An eye for country also, for the trend of the rivers, the slope of the hills, the cover of the woods, and the light green of the bogland."
Poor Nigel, who had trusted to his lance and to Pommers to break his path to glory, stood aghast at this list of needs.
"Alas," he cried, "how am I to gain all this? I, who could scarce learn to read or write, though the good Father Matthew broke a hazel stick a day across my shoulders."
"You will gain it, fair son, where others have gained it before you. You have that which is the first thing of all, a heart of fire, from which other colder hearts may catch a spark. But you must have knowledge also of that which warfare has taught us in olden times. We know, par exemple, that horsemen alone cannot hope to win against good foot soldiers. Has it not been tried at Courtai, at Stirling, and again under my own eyes at Crecy, where the chivalry of France went down before our bowmen?"
Nigel stared at him with a perplexed brow. "Fair sir, my heart grows heavy as I hear you. Do you then say that our chivalry can make no head against archers, billmen, and the like?"
"Nay, Nigel, for it has also been very clearly shown that the best foot soldiers, unsupported, cannot hold their own against the mailed horsemen."
"To whom then is the victory?" asked Nigel.
"To him who can mix his horse and foot, using each to strengthen the other. Apart, they are weak. Together, they are strong. The archer who can weaken the enemy's line, the horseman who can break it when it is weakened, as was not Falkirk and Duplin. There is the secret of our strength. Now, touching this same battle of Falkirk, I pray you for one instant to give it your attention."
With his whip he began to trace a plan of the Scottish battle upon the dust, and Nigel, with knitted brows, was trying hard to muster his small stock of brains and to profit by the lecture, when the conversation was interrupted by a strange new arrival. It was a very stout little man, wheezy and purple with haste, who scudded down the rampart as if he were blown by the wind, his grizzled hair flying, and his long black gown floating behind him.
He was clad in the dress of a respectable citizen, a black jerkin trimmed with sable, a black velvet beaver hat and a white feather. At the sight of Chandos, he gave a cry of joy and quickened his pace, so that when he did at last reach him, he could only stand gasping and waving his hands.
"Give yourself time, good Master Wintersoul. Give yourself time," said Chandos in a soothing voice.
"The papers!" gasped the little man. "Oh, my Lord Chandos, the papers!"
"What of the papers, my worthy sir?"
"I swear by our good patron St. Leonard, it is no fault of mine. I had locked them in my coffer, but the lock was forced and the coffer rifled."
A shadow of anger passed over the soldier's keen face.
"How now, Master Mayor? Pull your wits together, and do not stand there babbling like a three-year child. Do you say that someone hath taken the papers?"
"It is sooth, fair sir. Thrice I have been mayor of the town, and 15 years burgess and jurat, but never once has any public matter gone awry through me. Only last month they came an order from Windsor on a Tuesday for a Friday banquet. 1,000 souls, 4,000 plaice, 2,000 mackerel, 500 crabs, 1,000 lobsters, 5,000 whiting.
I doubt not, Master Mayor, that you are an excellent fishmonger, but the matter concerns the papers I gave into your keeping. Where are they?"
"Taken, fair sir, gone."
"And who hath dared to take them?"
"Alas, I know not. It was but for as long as you would say an angelus that I left the chamber, and when I came back, there was the coffer, broken and empty upon my table."
"Do you suspect no one?"
"There was a varlet who hath come with the last few days into my employ. He is not to be found, and I have sent horsemen along both the Udimore road and that to Rye that they may seize him. By the help of St. Leonard, they can scarce miss him, for one can tell him a bow shot off by his hair."
"Is it red?"
asked Chandos eagerly.
"Is it fox red? And the man, a small man, pocked with sunspots, and very quick in his movements?"
"It is the man himself."
Chandos shook his clenched hand with annoyance, and then set off swiftly down the street.
"It is Peter the Red Ferret once more," said he. "I knew him of old in France, where he has done us more harm than a company of men-at-arms. He speaks English as he speaks French, and he is of such daring and cunning that nothing is secret from him. In all France there is no more dangerous man, for though he is a gentleman of blood and coat armor, he takes the part of a spy, because it hath the more danger, and therefore the more honor."
"But, my fair lord," cried the mayor, as he hurried along, keeping pace with the long strides of the soldier, I knew that you warned me to take all care of the papers, but surely there was no matter of great import in it. It was but to say what stores were to be sent after you to Calais."
"Is that not everything?" cried Chandos impatiently. "Can you not see, O foolish Master Wintersoul, that the French suspect we are about to make some attempt, and that they have sent Peter the Red Ferret, as they have sent him many times before, to get tidings of whither we are bound? Now that he knows that the stores are for Calais, then the French near Calais will take his warning, and so the king's whole plan come to nothing."
"Then he will fly by water. We can stop him yet. He has not an hour's start."
"It may be that a boat awaits him at Rye or Hythe, but it is more like that he has already to depart from here. Ah, see yonder. I'll warrant that the Red Ferret is on board."
Chandos had halted in front of his inn, and now he pointed down to the outer harbour, which lay 2 miles off across the green plain. It was connected by a long winding canal with the inner dock at the base of the hill, upon which the town was built. Between the two horns formed by the short curving piers, a small schooner was running out to sea, dipping and rising before a sharp southerly breeze.
"It is no Winchelsea boat," said the mayor. "She is longer and broader in the beam than ours."
"Horses! Bring horses!" cried Chandos. "Come, Nigel, let us go further into the matter."
A busy crowd of varlets, archers, and men-at-arms swarmed round the gateway of the sign of the Broompod, singing, shouting, and jostling in rough good fellowship. The sight of the tall, thin figure of Chandos brought order amongst them, and a few minutes later the horses were ready and saddled. A breakneck ride down a steep declivity, and then a gallop of 2 miles over the sedgy plain, carried them to the outer harbour. A dozen vessels were lying there, ready to start for Bordeaux or Rochelle, and the quay was thick with sailors, labourers, and townsmen, and heaped with wine barrels and wool packs.
"Who is warden here?" asked Chandos, springing from his horse.
"Badding! Where is Cock Badding? Badding is warden!" shouted the crowd.
A moment later, a short, swarthy man, bull-necked and deep-chested, pushed through the people. He was clad in rough russet wool, with a scarlet cloth tied round his black curly head. His sleeves were rolled up to his shoulders, and his brown arms, all stained with grease and tar, were like two thick gnarled branches from an oaken stump. His savage brown face was fierce and frowning, and was split from chin to temple with a long white wail of an ill-healed wound.
"Oh, no, gentles, will you never wait your turn?" he rumbled in a deep, angry voice. "Can you not see that we are warping the Rose of Guienne into midstream for the ebb tide? Is this a time to break in upon us? Your goods will go aboard in due season, I promise you. So ride back into the town and find such pleasure as you may, while I and my mates do our work without let or hindrance."
"It is the gentle Chandos," cried someone in the crowd. "It is the good Sir John." The rough harbour-master changed his gruffness to smiles in an instant.
"Nay, Sir John, what would you? I pray you to hold me excused if I was short of speech, but we port wardens are sore plagued with foolish young lordlings who get betwixt us and our work, and blame us because we do not turn an ebb tide into a flood, or a south wind into a north. I pray you to tell me, how can I serve you?"
"That boat," said Chandos, pointing to the already distant sail rising and falling on the waves.
"What is it?"
Cock Badding shaded his keen eyes with his strong brown hand.
"She has just gone out," said he. "She is La Pucelle, a small wainsloop from Gascony, homebound and laden with barrel staves."
"I pray you, did any man join her at the very last?"
"Nay, I know not. I saw no one."
"But I know," cried a seaman in the crowd. "I was standing at the wharf-side, and was nigh knocked into the water by a little red-headed fellow, who breathed as though he had run from the town. Ere I had time to give him a cuff, he had jumped aboard, the ropes were cast off, and her nose was seaward."
In a few words, Chandos made all clear to Badding, the crowd pressing eagerly round.
"Aye, aye," cried a seaman, "the good Sir John is right. See how she points. It is Picardy, and not Gascony, that you will fetch this journey, in spite of her wine staves."
"Then we must lay her aboard," cried Cock Badding. "Come, lads, here is my own Murray Rose ready to cast off. Who's for a trip with a fight at the end of it?"
There was a rush for the boat, but the stout little seaman picked his men.
"Go back, Jerry. Your heart is good, but you are over fat for the work. You, Luke, and you, Thomas, and the two Deeds, and William of Sandgate, you will work the boat. And now we need a few men of their hands. Do you come, little sir?"
"I pray you, my dear lord, to let me go," cried Nigel.
"Yes, Nigel, you can go, and I will bring your gear over to Calais this night."
"I will join you there, fair sir, and with the help of St. Paul I will bring this red ferret with me."
"Aboard, aboard! Time passes," cried Badding impatiently,
while already his seamen were hauling on the line and raising the mainsail.
"Now then, sir, who are you?"
It was Aylward, who had followed Nigel and was pushing his way forward.
"Where my master goes, I go also," cried Aylward. "So stand clear, Master Shipman, or you may come by a hurt."
"By St. Leonard, Archer," said Cock Badding, "had I more time, I would give you a lesson ere I leave land. Stand back and give place to others."
"Nay, stand back and give place to me," cried Aylward.
And seizing Badding round the waist, he slung him into the dock. There was a cry of anger from the crowd, for Badding was the hero of all the Cinque Ports, and had never yet met his match in manhood. The epitaph still lingers, in which it was said that he could never rest until he had foughten his fill. When, therefore, swimming like a duck, he reached a rope and pulled himself hand over hand up to the quay, all stood aghast to see what fell fate would befall this bold stranger. But Badding laughed loudly, dashing the salt water from his eyes and hair.
"You have fairly won your place, Archer," said he. "You are the very man for our work. Where is Black Simon of Norwich?"
A tall, dark young man with a long, stern, lean face came forward.
"I am with you, Cock," said he, "and I thank you for my place."
"You can come, Hugh Battlesmere, and you, Hal Masters, and you, Deacon of Rye. That is enough. Now off in God's name, or it will be night ere we can come up with them."
Already the headsails and mainsails had been raised, while 100 willing hands pulled her off from the wharf. Now the wind caught her, heeling over, and, quivering with eagerness like an unleashed hound, she flew through the opening and out into the channel. She was a famous little schooner, the Marie Rose of Winchelsea, and under her daring owner, Cock Badding, half trader and half pirate, she had brought back into port many a rich cargo taken out in mid-channel, and paid for it in blood rather than money. Small as she was, her great speed and the fierce character of her master had made her a name of terror along the French coast, and many a bulky Eastlander or Fleming, as he passed the narrow seas, had scanned the distant Kentish shore, fearing lest that ill-omened purple sail with a gold Christopher upon it should shoot out suddenly from the dim grey cliffs. Now she was clear of the land, with the wind on her larboard quarter, every inch of canvas set, and her high, sharp bows smothered in foam as she dug through the waves. Cock Badding trod the deck with head erect and jaunty bearing, glancing up at the swelling sails, and then ahead at the little tilted white triangle which stood out clear and hard against the bright blue sky. Behind was the lowland of the Camber Marshes, with the bluffs of Rye and Winchelsea, and the line of cliffs behind them. On the larboard bow rose the great white walls of Folkestone and of Dover, and far off, on the distant skyline, the great shimmer of those French cliffs for which the fugitives were making. "By St. Paul," cried Nigel, looking with eager eyes over the tossing waters, "it seems to me, Master Badding, that already we draw in upon them." The master measured the distance with his keen, steady gaze, and then looked up at the sinking sun.
"We still have 4 hours of daylight," said he, "but if we do not lay her aboard ere darkness falls, she will save herself, for the nights are as black as a wolf's mouth, and if she alter her course, I know not how we may follow her. Unless, indeed, you might guess to which port she was bound, and reach it before her."
"Well thought of, little master," cried Badding. "If the news be for the French outside Calais, then Ambleteuse would be the nearest to St. Omer. But my sweeting sails 3 paces to that lubber's 2, and if the wind holds, we shall have time and to spare."
"How now, Archer? You do not seem so eager as when you made your way aboard this boat by slinging me into the sea."
Aylward sat on the upturned keel of a skiff which lay upon the deck. He groaned sadly and held his green face between his 2 hands.
"I would gladly sling you into the sea once more, Master Shipman," said he, "if by so doing I could get off this most accursed vessel of thine, or if you would wish to have your turn, then I would thank you if you would lend me a hand over the side, for indeed I am but a useless weight upon your deck. Little did I think that Samkin Aylward could be turned into a weakling by an hour of salt water. Alas the day that ever my foot wandered from the good red heather of Crooksbury!"
Cock Badding laughed loud and long.
"Nay, take it not to heart, Archer," he cried, "for better men than you or I have groaned upon this deck. The prince himself, with 10 of his chosen knights, crossed with me once, and 11 sadder faces I never saw. Yet, within a month, they had shown at Cressy that they were no weaklings, as you will do also, I dare swear, when the time comes. Keep that thick head of thine down upon the planks, and all will be well anon. We raise her with every blast of the wind." It was indeed evident, even to the inexperienced eyes of Nigel, that the Marie Rose was closing in swiftly upon the stranger. She was a heavy, bluff-bowed, broad-sterned vessel which laboured clumsily through the seas. The swift, fierce little Winchelsea boat, swooping and hissing through the waters behind her, was like some keen hawk whizzing downwind at the back of a flapping, heavy-bodied duck. Half an hour before, La Pucelle had been a distant patch of canvas. Now they could see the black hull, and soon the cut of her sails and the lines of her bulwarks. There were at least 12 men upon her deck, and the twinkle of weapons from amongst them showed that they were preparing to resist. Cock Badding began to muster his own forces. He had a crew of 7 rough, hardy mariners, who had been at his back in many a skirmish. They were armed with short swords, but Cock Badding carried a weapon peculiar to himself, a 20-pound blacksmith's hammer, the memory of which, as Badding's cracker, still lingers in the Cinqueports. Then there were the eager Nigel, the melancholy Aylward, Black Simon, who was a tried swordsman, and 3 archers, Baddlesmere, Masters, and Deacon of Rye, all veterans of the French War. The numbers in the 2 vessels might be about equal, but Badding, as he glanced at the bold, harsh faces which looked to him for orders, had little fear for the result. Glancing round, however, he saw something which was more dangerous to his plans than the resistance of the enemy. The wind, which had become more fitful and feebler, now fell suddenly away till the sails hung limp and straight above them. A belt of calm lay along the horizon, and the waves around had smoothed down into a long, oily swell on which the 2 little vessels rose and fell. The great boom of the Marie Rose rattled, jarred with every lurch, and the high, thin prow pointed skyward one instant and seaward the next in a way that drew fresh groans from the unhappy Aylward.
In vain Cock Badding pulled on his sheets and tried hard to husband every little wandering gust which ruffled for an instant the sleek rollers. The French master was as adroit a sailor, and his boom swung round also as each breath of wind came up from astern. At last, even these fitful puffs died finally away, and a cloudless sky overhung a glassy sea. The sun was almost upon the horizon behind Dungeness Point, and the whole western heaven was bright with the glory of the sunset, which blended sea and sky in one blaze of ruddy light. Like rollers of molten gold, the long swell heaved up channel from the great ocean beyond. In the midst of the immense beauty and peace of nature, the two little dark specks, with the white sail and the purple, rose and fell, so small upon the vast shining bosom of the waters, and yet so charged with all the unrest and the passion of life. The experienced eye of the seaman told him that it was hopeless to expect a breeze before nightfall. He looked across at the Frenchman, which lay less than a quarter of a mile ahead, and shook his gnarled fist at the line of heads which could be seen looking back over her stern. One of them waved a white kerchief in derision, and Cock Badding swore a bitter oath at the sight. "By St. Leonard of Winchelsea," he cried, "I will rub my side up against her yet. Out with the skiff, lads, and two of you to the oars. Make fast the line to the mast, Will. Do you go into the boat, Hugh, and I'll make the second. Now, if we bend our backs to it, we may have them yet ere night cover them." The little skiff was swiftly lowered over the side, and the slack end of the cable fastened to the after thwart. Cock Badding and his comrades pulled as if they would snap their oars, and the little vessel began slowly to lurch forward over the rollers. But the next moment a larger skiff had splashed over the side of the Frenchman, and no less than four seamen were hard at work under her bows. If the Marie Rose advanced a yard, the Frenchman was going too. Again Cock Badding raved and shook his fist. He clambered aboard, his face wet with sweat and dark with anger. "Curse them! They have the best of us," he cried. "I can do no more. Sir John has lost his papers. For indeed, now that night is at hand, I can see no way in which we can gain them." Nigel had leaned against the bulwark during these events, watching with keen attention the doings of the sailors, and praying alternately to St. Paul, St. George, and St. Thomas for a slant of wind which would put them alongside their enemy. He was silent, but his hot heart was simmering within him. His spirit had risen even above the discomfort of the sea, and his mind was too absorbed in his mission to have a thought for that which had laid Aylward flat upon the deck. He had never doubted that Cock Badding, in one way or another, would accomplish his end, but when he heard his speech of despair, he bounded off the bulwark and stood before the seaman, with his face flushed and all his soul afire. "By St. Paul, Master Shipman," he cried, "we should never hold up our heads in honor if we did not go further into the matter. Let us do some small deed this night upon the water, or let us never see land again, for indeed we could not wish fair a prospect of winning honorable advancement." "With your leave, little master, you speak like a fool," said the gruff seaman. "You and all your kind are as children when once the blue water is beneath you. Can you not see that there is no wind, and that the Frenchman can warp her as swiftly as we? What then would you do?" Nigel pointed to the boat which towed astern. "Let us venture forth in her," said he, "and let us take this ship, or die worshipful in the attempt." His bold and fiery words found their echo in the brave rough hearts around him. There was a deep-chested shout from both archers and seamen. Even Aylward sat up, with a wan smile upon his green face. But Cock Badding shook his head. "I have never met the man who could lead where I would not follow," said he. "By St. Leonard, this is a mad business, and I should be a fool if I were to risk my men and my ship. Bethink you, little master, that the skiff can only hold five, though you load her to the water's edge. If there is a man yonder, there are 14, and you have to claim their side from the boat. What chance would you have? Your boat stove and you in the water, there is the end of it. No man of mine goes on such a fool's errand, and so I swear." "Then, Master Badding, I must crave the loan of your skiff. For by St. Paul, the good Lord Chandos's papers are not to be so lightly lost. If no one else will come, then I will go alone." The shipman smiled at the words, but the smile died away from his lips when Nigel, with features set like ivory and eyes as hard as steel, pulled on the rope so as to bring the skiff under the counter. It was very clear that he would do even as he said.
At the same time Aylward raised his bulky form from the deck, leaned for a moment against the bulwarks, and then tottered aft to his master's side.
"Here is one who will go with you," said he, "or he would never dare show his face to the girls of Tilford again. Come, archers, let us leave these salt herrings in their pickle-tub and try out our luck on the water."
The three archers at once ranged themselves on the same side as their comrade. They were bronze, bearded men, short in stature, as were most Englishmen of that day, but hardy, strong, and skilled with their weapons. Each drew his string from its waterproof case and bent the huge arc of his war-bow as he fitted it into the nocks. "Now, master, we are at your back," said they, as they pulled and tightened their sword-belts. But already Cock Badding had been carried away by the hot lust of battle and had thrown aside every fear and doubt which had clouded him. To see a fight and not be in it was more than he could bear.
"Oh, nay, have it your own way," he cried, "and may St. Leonard help us, for a madder venture I have never seen. And yet it may be worth the trial. But if it be done, let me have the handling of it, little master, for you know no more of a boat than I do of a war-horse. The skiff can bear five, and not a man more. Now, who will come?"
They had all caught fire, and there was not one who would be left out. Badding picked up his hammer.
"I will come myself," said he. "And you also, little master, since it is your hot head that has planned it. Then there is Black Simon, the best sword of the Cinque-Ports. Two archers can pull on the oars, and it may be that they can pick off two or three of these Frenchmen before we close with them. Hugh Badlesmere, and you, Deacon of Rye, into the boat with you."
"What?" cried Aylward. "Am I to be left behind? I, who am the squire's own man? Ill fare the bowman who comes betwixt me and yonder boat."
"Nay, Aylward," said his master, "I order that you stay, for indeed you are a sick man."
"But now that the waves have sunk, I am myself again. Nay, fair sir, I pray that you will not leave me behind."
"You must needs make the space for a better man, for what do you know of the handling of a boat?" said Badding shortly. "No more fool's talk, I pray you, for the night will soon fall. Stand aside."
Aylward looked hard at the French boat.
"I could swim 10 times up and down Frensham Pond," said he, "and it will be strange if I cannot go as far as that. By these 10 finger-bones, Samkin Aylward may be there as soon as you."
The little boat, with its 5 occupants, pushed off from the side of the schooner, and dipping and rising made its slow way towards the Frenchman. Badding and one archer had single oars. The second archer was in the prow, while Black Simon and Nigel huddled into the stern, with the water lapping and hissing at their very elbows. A shout of defiance rose from the Frenchmen, and they stood in a line along the side of their vessel, shaking their fists and waving their weapons. Already the sun was level with Dungeness, and the grey of evening was blurring sky and water into one dim haze. A great silence hung over the broad expanse of nature, and no sound broke it save the dip and splash of the oars and the slow deep surge of the boat upon the swell. Behind them their comrades of the Marie Rose stood motionless and silent, watching their progress with eager eyes. They were near enough now to have a good look at the Frenchmen. One was a big swarthy man with a long black beard. He had a red cap and an axe over his shoulder. There were 10 other hardy-looking fellows, all of them well-armed, and there were 3 who seemed to be boys.
"Shall we try a shaft upon them?" asked Hugh Badlesmere. "They are well within our bowshot." "Only one of you can shoot at a time, for you have no footing," said Badding. "With 1 foot in the prow and the other over a thwart, you will get your stance. Do what you may, and then we will close in upon them."
The archer balanced himself in the rolling boat with the deftness of a man who has been trained upon the sea, for he was born and bred in the Cinque-Ports. Carefully he knocked his arrow. Strongly he drew it, steadily he loosed it, but the boat swooped at the instant, and it buried itself in the waves. The second passed over the little ship, and the third struck in her black side. Then, in quick succession, so quick that 2 shafts were often in the air at the same instant, he discharged 12 arrows, most of which just cleared the bulwarks and dropped upon the deck. There was a cry on the Frenchman, and the heads vanished from the side.
"Enough!" cried Badding. "One is down, and it may be 2. Close in God's name, before they rally!"
He and the other bent to their oars, but at the same instant there was a sharp zip in the air and a hard, clear sound, like a stone striking a wall. Badlesmere clapped his hand to his head, groaned, and fell forward out of the boat, leaving a swirl of blood upon the surface.
A moment later the same fierce hiss ended in a loud wooden crash, and a short, thick crossbow bolt was buried deep in the side of their boat.
"Close in! Close in!" roared Badding, tugging at his oar. "By St. George for England! St. Leonard for Winchelsea! Close in!"
But again that fatal crossbow twanged. Deacon of Rye fell back with a shaft through his shoulder.
"God help me, I can no more," said he.
Badding seized the oar from his hand, but it was only to sweep the boat's head round and pull her back to the Marie Rose. The attack had failed.
"What now, Master Shipman?" cried Nigel. "What has befallen to stop us? Surely the matter does not end here."
"Two down out of five," said Badding, "and 12 at least against us. The odds are too long, little master. Let us at least go back, fill up once more, and raise a mantlet against the bolts, for they have an arbalest which shoots both straight and hard. But what we do we must do quickly, for the darkness falls apace."
Their repulse had been hailed by wild yells of delight from the Frenchmen, who danced with joy and waved their weapons madly over their heads. But before their rejoicings had finished, they saw the little boat creeping out once more from the shadow of the Marie Rose, a great wooden screen in her bows to protect her from the arrows. Without a pause she came straight and fast for her enemy. The wounded archer had been put on board, and Aylward would have had his place had Nigel been able to see him upon the deck. The third archer, Hal Masters, had sprung in, and one of the seamen, Wat Finnis of Hythe. With their hearts hardened to conquer or die, the five ran alongside the Frenchman and sprang upon her deck. At the same instant a great iron weight crashed through the bottom of their skiff, and their feet had hardly left her before she was gone. There was no hope and no escape save victory. The crossbowman stood under the mast, his terrible weapon at his shoulder, the steel string stretched taut, the heavy bolt shining upon the nut. One life at least he would claim out of this little band. Just for one instant too long did he dwell upon his aim, shifting from the seaman to Cock Badding, whose formidable appearance showed him to be the better prize. In that second of time Hal Master's string twanged, and his long arrow sped through the arbalaster's throat. He dropped on the deck with blood and curses pouring from his mouth. A moment later Nigel's sword and Badding's hammer had each claimed a victim and driven back the rush of assailants. The five were safe upon the deck, but it was hard for them to keep their footing there. The French seamen, Bretons and Normans, were stout, powerful fellows, armed with axes and swords, fierce fighters and brave men. They swarmed round the little band, attacking them from all sides. Black Simon fell to the black-bearded French captain, and at the same instant was cut over the head and lay with his scalp open upon the deck. The seaman, Wat of Hythe, was killed by a crashing blow from an axe. Nigel was struck down, but was up again like a flash, and drove his sword through the man who had felled him. But Badding, Masters the archer, and he had been hustled back to the bulwark, and were barely holding their own from minute to minute against a fierce crowd who assailed them, when an arrow coming apparently from the sea struck the foremost Frenchman to the heart. A moment later a boat dashed up alongside, and four more men from the Marie Rose scrambled onto the blood-stained deck. With one fierce rush the remaining Frenchmen were struck down or were seized by the assailants. Nine prostrate men upon the deck showed how fierce had been the attack, how desperate the resistance. Badding leaned, panting, upon his blood-clotted hammer.
"By St. Leonard," he cried, "I thought that this little master had been the death of us all. God, what, you were but just in time, and how you came I know not. This archer has had a hand in it, by the look of him."
Aylward, still pale from his sea-sickness and dripping from head to foot with water, had been the first man in the rescue party. Nigel looked at him in amazement.
"I sought you aboard the ship, Aylward, but I could not lay eyes on you," said he.
"It was because I was in the water, fair sir, and by my hilt it suits my stomach better than being on it," he answered. "When you first set forth I swam behind you, for I saw that the Frenchman's boat hung by a rope, and I thought that while you kept him in play I might gain it. I had reached it when you were driven back, so I hid behind it in the water, and said my prayers as I have not said them for many a day. Then you came again, and no one had an eye for me, so I clambered into it, cut the rope, took the oars which I found there, and brought her back for more men."
"By St. Paul, you have acted very wisely and well," said Nigel, "and I think that of all of us it is you who have won most honour this day."
"But of all these men, dead and alive, I see none who resembles that red ferret whom my Lord Chandos has described, and who has worked such despite upon us in the past.
It would indeed be an evil chance if he has, in spite of all of our pains, made his way to France in some other boat."
"That we shall soon find out," said Badding. "Come with me, and we will search the ship from truck to keel ere he escapes us."
There was a scuttle at the base of the mast, which led down into the body of the vessel, and the Englishmen were approaching this when a strange sight brought them to a stand. A round, brazen head had appeared in the square, dark opening. An instant afterward, a pair of shining shoulders followed. Then, slowly, the whole figure of a man in complete plate armor emerged on the deck. In his gauntleted hand he carried a heavy steel mace. With this uplifted, he moved toward his enemies, silent save for the ponderous clank of his footfall. It was an inhuman, machine-like figure, menacing and terrible, devoid of all expression, slow-moving, inexorable and awesome. A sudden wave of terror passed over the English seamen. One of them tried to pass and get behind the brazen man, but he was pinned against the side by a quick movement, and his brains dashed out by a smashing blow from the heavy mace. Wild panic seized the others, and they rushed back to the boat. Aylward strung an arrow, but his bowstring was damp, and the shaft rang loudly upon the shining breastplate and glanced off into the sea. Masters struck the brazen head with a sword, but the blade snapped without injuring the helmet, and an instant later the bowman was stretched senseless on the deck. The seamen shrank from this terrible, silent creature, and huddled in the stern, all the fight gone out of them. Again he raised his mace, and was advancing on the helpless crowd, where the brave were encumbered and hampered by the weaklings, when Nigel shook himself clear, and bounded forward into the open, his sword in his hand, and a smile of welcome upon his lips. The sun had set, and one long mauve gash across the western channel was closing swiftly into the dull greys of early night. Above, a few stars began to faintly twinkle, yet the twilight was still bright enough for an observer to see every detail of the scene. The Marie Rose, dipping and rising on the long rollers astern, the broad French boat with its white deck blotched with blood and littered with bodies, the group of men in the stern, some trying to advance, and some seeking to escape, all a confused, disorderly, struggling rabble. Then, betwixt them and the mast, the two figures, the armed, shining man of metal with hand upraised, watchful, silent, motionless, and Nigel, bareheaded and crouching, with quick foot, eager eyes, and fearless, happy face, moving this way and that, in and out, his sword flashing like a gleam of light, as he sought at all points for some opening in a brazen shell before him. It was clear to the man in armour that if he could but pen his antagonist in a corner, he would beat him down without fail, but it was not to be done. The unhampered man had the advantage of speed. With a few quick steps, he could always glide to either side and escape the clumsy rush. Aylward and Badding had sprung out to Nigel's assistance, but he shouted to them to stand back with such authority and anger in his voice that their weapons dropped to their sides. With staring eyes and set features, they stood watching that unequal fight. Once it seemed that all was over with the squire, for in springing back from his enemy, he tripped over one of the bodies which strewed the deck and fell flat upon his back, but with a swift wriggle he escaped the heavy blow which thundered down upon him, and springing to his feet, he bit deeply into the Frenchman's helmet with a sweeping cut in return. Again the mace fell, and this time Nigel had not quite cleared himself. His sword was beaten down, and the blow fell partly upon his left shoulder. He staggered, and once more the iron club whirled upward to dash him to the ground. Quick as a flash, it passed through his mind that he could not leap beyond its reach, but he might get within it. In an instant he had dropped his sword, and springing in, he had seized the brazen man round the waist. The mace was shortened, and the handle jobbed down once more upon the bare flaxen head. Then, with a sonorous clang and a yell of delight from the spectators, Nigel, with one mighty wrench, tore his enemy from the deck and hurled him down upon his back. His own head was whirling, and he felt that his senses were slipping away, but already his hunting knife was out and pointing through the slit in the brazen helmet. "Give yourself up, fair sir," said he. "Never to fishermen and to archers. I am a gentleman of coat armor. Kill me." "I also am a gentleman of coat armor. I promise you quarter."
"Then, sir, I surrender myself to you."
The dagger tinkled down upon the deck. Seamen and archers ran forward to find Nigel half senseless upon his face. They drew him off, and a few deft blows, struck off the helmet of his enemy. A head, sharp-featured, freckled and foxy red, disclosed itself beneath it. Nigel raised himself on his elbow for an instant. "You are the Red Ferret," said he. "So my enemies call me," said the Frenchman with a smile. "I rejoice, sir, that I have fallen to so valiant and honourable a gentleman."
"I thank you, fair sir," said Nigel feebly. "I also rejoice that I have encountered so debonair a person, and I shall ever bear in mind the pleasure which I have had from our meeting." So saying, he laid his bleeding head upon his enemy's brazen front and sank into a dead faint. End of chapter 14.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.